The following is a Japan Society lecture program audio podcast. For more information about Japan Society's programs, please visit www.japansociety.org. And welcome to Japan Society. I'm Robert Fish, Director of Education and Lecture Programs, and we're pleased to have you for tonight's lecture, Millennial Monsters, Japanese Toys, and the Global Imagination. This is one of many. We have a very busy May here at Japan Society, so this is one of many exciting programs. If I could just point out two other programs that will be coming up later this month. On May 13th at 6:30 p.m., we'll have a lecture panel on hidden beauty in Edo design, which actually builds upon our wonderful gallery exhibition, The Genius of Japanese Lacquer, Masterworks of Shibata Zeishin, which will run through June 15th. And another exciting program coming up on May 20th at 6:30 p.m., a community dialogue, Innovation and the Art of Future Building, looking at how new approaches to problem solving in Japan, which will look at how new approaches to problem solving in Japan and the United States are helping people envision a brighter future, as well as the many other programs you can see in your program. Before we get to tonight's program, though, which I'm very excited about, you're going to hear from Ann Allison. If I could ask everybody to just please turn off your cell phones, pagers, other devices that will beep in the night, we'd appreciate that. And I'm pleased to introduce, not Ann Allison, who is here, trust me, but the moderator of tonight's program. We're also very lucky to have Professor Thomas Lucer, who is Associate Professor in the Department of East Asian Studies at New York University, and a scholar of Japan with one of the broader approaches to studying Japanese culture, who has studied and published on things ranging from early modern no theater right up to anime. He's right now a leading voice in the study of Japanese popular culture, appropriate for this evening, and serves on the editorial board of Mechademia, which is a journal devoted to the study of Japanese popular culture and its reception around the world. So with no further ado to start the program, I'll turn it over to Professor Lucer.
Leading voice, I don't know. Thank you very much for the introduction and for being the invitation to be part of this evening's program and the discussion with Anne. I first met Anne just a few years ago at the University of Chicago, where we overlapped briefly as graduate students, and was, I think, the very first University of Chicago student in anthropology to get a degree in Japan on Japanese studies. And since then, she's gone on to great things. Along with a wide variety of articles, book reviews, commentaries, and so on, the book on millennial monsters that I think she'll talk on tonight is already her third. Excuse me. And to give you just a quick sense of how active she is, I was looking at her CV, and between the years of 2005 and 2007, she gave approximately 50 academic talks. I won't try and list the titles, although they're not boring, I assure you. And this was while serving as chair of her department in anthropology at Duke, while teaching, while writing, and so on. She is truly a global scholar, and this seems to be verified by the fact that she has her own entry in Wikipedia, something we all aspire to, I'm sure. The kind of material Anne has been working with, global pop culture, might be a little more important than it might, at least on superficially seem. And economically, it's one of the main driving forces in a variety of ways of international wealth. It has also served as the battleground for politics, and the Japanese government continues now to look for ways to bring pop culture into their sphere of control. But more simply, pop culture increasingly has become the definitive basis, I think, for thinking about culture, including cultural change, and cultural difference in general. Anne may be one of the first students to have managed an anthropology degree in Japan at Chicago, but since then, she's also managed to show the importance of global pop culture at a time when there isn't much point anymore in dreaming of small, isolated villages as a model for cultural difference. That's not the way our world works anymore. Working with pop culture might also sound like fun, and a pretty easy, the basis at least, of a pretty easy career. Maybe it is fun, but it isn't easy. And getting some sense of mastery over material that seems to expand endlessly and with incredible speed, and then being able to say something intelligent about that material, can start to feel almost impossible, I know. Anne has managed to provide clear perspective on what is going on in very, very immediately around us. And she's also managed to do it in ways that are clear and interesting instead of dryly analytical. And I've heard her talk before, so I know that too. So I'm happy to be here, and I think we can look forward to hear what she has to say.
Thank you, Tom, for that lovely introduction, and thank you to the Japan Society for inviting me, and thank you all for being here. So I have a half an hour to tell you about my book, and I've never done this before in half an hour, so I do have a watch, and we'll see how it goes. So I would like you to imagine this. It's 1945. It's the end of the war. Japan has been defeated, as we all know. Its infrastructure has been destroyed. Many people have been killed. The country is in ruins, and it's not clear how the economy is going to get started again. So one of the first things that actually started the post-war economy was toys. So for those of you who think toys, as Tom had said, about pop culture, is simply about fun, part of what I've done in my book is talk about how toys are also a part of the economy. And after the war, the toy industry was one of the first industries to restart. But one of the problems was that there was very few raw materials in order to create toys. And so can anyone figure out what was the raw material that created these toys? Bullets. It wasn't bullets. The war was over. good suggestion. It was tin cans, and the tin cans came from the GI rations. So Japan, as you all know, of course, was occupied by the United States between 1945 and 1952. And so some enterprising Japanese metal workers took these tin cans and recycled them and made them into toys. And the toys were primarily for export. In fact, toys like these tin cans with MPs, so military police, this is also written in English. So the consumers were not Japanese kids. It was said that, in fact, Japanese kids were not yet ready for toys, because there were more serious things that they were concerned with, like trying to find food, but that American kids had been deprived during the war and they hadn't had toys. So these toys that were recycled GI tin rations were sent over to the United States, and toys like this that were found to be very enterprising by the Supreme Command Allied powers were also the first commodity to be exported after the war to the United States. So in part what I do in this book is to think about the relationship between toys and the economy and also the United States. So this was produced in about 1947. This is a different kind of toy. This is an ANA, All Nippon Airways, jet plane, circa about 1992, probably about 1999, with Pokemon all up and down the fuselage. So this was what I also talk about as another kind of toy. I mean, it's an airplane. It came at the height of the Pokemon fad. The Pokemon fad started in 1996. Some have called it the global fad of the 1990s. It is still, believe it or not, going on today. For those of you who have kids or who know anything about this. It's still on television. There's still Game Boy games that are being produced. So it's what's called in the business an evergreen product. So from these little tin cans that started out right after the war that were cheap, they were amusing but not given a whole lot of stature, they were recycled from tin cans at a moment when Japan was not really a power, had been defeated, to this, where you now see that Japan has become a culture producer of toys with incredible stature, with incredible global prestige. This is in part the story that I try to tell in the book, Millennial Monsters, Japanese Toys and the Global Imagination. So the end points are 1945 and now. And what I'm really interested in is the global circulation of Japanese cool. Some people call it J-cool. And this is one of the products. So, for example, everyone loves Japan. The rest of Asia goes crazy for Pokemon, Hello Kitty, and Tokyo Pop. It's cool to be cute. The New Yorker. I mean, just look at this cover of the New Yorker. So that is Pikachu, the iconic Pokemon of the global fad Pokemon, Pocket Monster. Hauling away green dollar bills. So at Halloween time. So it's also a sign of how Pokemon has crossed over, which is, again, one of the topics that I deal with in the book. How is it that it's gone from a very parochial place in the 1940s? Japan was not considered to be a culture producer. Japanese culture was still considered to be something that was okay for Japanese, but really had no crossover appeal, to something like this. So Halloween, of course, is that all-American holiday, and so Pikachu and Japanese toys and fads have now become a part of Americana. So part of the history that I trace in the book is I go back to that moment of 1945. I start off with these tin can toys. I go into the 1950s, and I talk about Godzilla, which was an incredible blockbuster hit, came out in 1954. I'm sure there are many people in this room who know the history of Godzilla, maybe even better than I do. But it was one of Toho Studios... At the time that it came out, they had never spent so much money on a movie. It was considered to be a really, I don't know if they thought of it as fine art, but Tsuburaya Eiji, who did the special effects, had the suitmation effect, which was a human actor puts on the costume, was considered incredibly interesting and sophisticated. The movie, as you I'm sure know, is about a beast that is underneath the Sea of Japan and then is triggered into action by nuclear testing done by, guess who, Americans. And not only is Godzilla spurred into action, but he also mutates. So now he's nuclearized. So I call this a cyborg. So in this chapter, I say from ashes to cyborgs. So from ashes out of defeat, because it's also an aesthetics of destruction. It's also a movie about Tokyo getting destroyed by this beast, which nonetheless is also, as I talk about in the book, something of a symbol of the future. Technology was incredibly important to the reconstruction of Japan. And even though Godzilla isn't exactly a heroic or superheroic figure, it nonetheless, by a lot of Japanese who I've spoken to, is considered an ambiguous character. It's not simply evil. It's not simply a destroyer. People are in part scared of Godzilla. In part, they have incredible admiration for Godzilla. So unlike the way that it was received in the United States, it was picked up for release. It was released in 1956. Raymond Burr was the actor in the American version. The American version was filmed in one day. The rights were bought for $30,000 by Dick Kay and made an incredible amount of money. And 28 movies, not all of which were translated into English, but 28 movies followed, so it was an incredible franchise property. Nonetheless, Godzilla has always been something of a cheesy character, I think, in the minds of America. So even though Godzilla was an incredibly important and a symbol of something that gave to Japanese a lot of pride, it carried over and crossed over into the global marketplace as something that also represented the fact that Japan was still a secondary cultural producer. So I talk a lot about this in the book. In the 50s, even though Japan was getting back on its feet economically, it started to produce not only movies, but much more importantly, manga and anime. A couple people in this room, Tom and also Susan Napier is here, who has done a lot of work on anime. Culture production and pop culture started getting produced and developed and accelerated 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. So Godzilla came at a time when Japan was starting to become a culture producer, but also its reception everywhere outside of Japan was something other than what its reception was in Japan. So in part, I deal with this in the book. In the book, too, I'm looking at this movement between this moment of time and the moment of time in the 90s when Japan has really become much more a preeminent and prominent and dominant cultural producer. And I do so around three different kind of themes. I look at fantasy. What is the fantasy of something like Godzilla? capitalism, political economy. How are products like this produced? How do they make money? How are they embedded in political economy? And the third theme I look at is globalization. How do they circulate outside of Japan? What is the orbit? What is the scope with which they travel? And overarching all of this, I ask a question about cultural politics. When Japanese goods like Gojira actually travel outside of Japan, what is the significance of the Japan, made in Japan? Is that something that is strong? Is it something that's weak? When people know that Pokemon today has been produced in Japan, does that reflect back on Japan as what some people call soft power? Is Japan now powerful because it is the producer of Pokemon? So these are the three, actually four issues that kind of ground my entire book. Who recognizes these? Okay. So I'm an anthropologist, as is Tom. And in anthropology, we do our work by what is called ethnography. So I did ethnographic field work in two places. I did it in Japan, because Japan is where all these goods have emanated from, and also in one of the places which now has become a major consumer of J-Cool, the United States. And if you're interested to know how I did ethnography, I can tell you later how I did my field work. I did it long and hard. So I watched a lot of shows, I played with a lot of toys, talked to a lot of people, read a lot of books. So this is, and I look at four waves of goods, toys, fantasies, children's fantasies that have crossed over from Japan to the United States, starting with what is called in the United States the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. And it started as a live-action television show in Japan in 1973, produced by Toei Studios. It was Himitsu Sentai Go Ranger, Five Rangers. This show is still on television today, if you can believe it. So it is really an evergreen, really an evergreen property. The concept of the show, I mean, to get to the issue, I mean, this is a particular kind of fantasy. It's a team heroes. If there's anyone in the room who doesn't know the idea of the Rangers, the idea is that these are normal, everyday high school kids who, when confronted by evil in the shape of kaiju monsters who are set on destroying the world, they transform, henshin, with the morphing poses, and they take off and they become empowered in various ways. I mean, they often have robots that are also vehicles. They're called vehicular robots. They have sometimes spirits. They have different costumes. And they operate together as a team. So in the book, I call this, for anyone who knows this language, I call this not a Fordist hero. I call this a post-Fordist hero in the sense that it's a team working together. In contrast to something like Superman, which is the American notion of a superhero. And Superman works by himself. I mean, he's a great hero, but he's all by himself. So he's very individual, and he has that little outfit on, and no one really can become Superman. By contrast, you have a whole team here, and they also change by season. So by season, there are different members. It seems a little more democratic. Females can be heroes now. And also in the Japanese version, often at the end of a season, one of the Rangers dies. Can you imagine Superman actually dying? And in the new season, there will be a different Ranger to replace him or her. The concept of this was started by Bandai, which is a toy company. So again, to think about political economy, Bandai wanted to sell toys. And it decided that the way to do that is to come up with a good concept that would be on television. Television was incredibly instrumental, a critical component to pop culture, particularly kids' pop culture. This was in the 70s. The first economic boom of the post-war period was 1968. Japan was becoming more and more successful. The economic miracle was taking off. Also, Japan's consumer culture was really getting grounded, and kids became an incredible target for selling goods. So Bandai was a medium-sized toy company at the time. Through the sales of, through this whole concept and through the sales of its toys, it became the number one toy company. And part of the idea is this. Every season, there's a new show, which means every season, there's new toy merchandise. So if you get a kid hooked on Rangers, then after one season, they might have bought all five characters with all those vehicular robots and all those. So now they want another five characters. So the idea is incredibly capitalistically clever. So it's a fantasy, but it also is a part of political economy. But it didn't globalize until the 1990s. In 1985, an American entrepreneur by the name of Haim Saban was in Japan. He saw one episode of the Rangers, Judenja, which was the dinosaur version, was very captivated by it, thought that it would be a winner, thought that American kids would love this show. He tried for 8 years to sell it to an American network. No one was interested in signing on. Can anyone imagine why? No Americans. They thought no Americans, and they thought that it was also kind of cheesy, like Godzilla, that American kids were too sophisticated, that they wouldn't find this enjoyable. The transformation was something that was kind of childish. But then it was signed on by Margaret Leche, who then was at Fox Kids Network, because she had been raised on Speed Racer, which I understand is showing tonight. So she thought actually that American kids would find this interesting, but because the actors, and here you can't tell who they are because this is their post-morphed appearance, but in their pre-morphed appearance, they look Japanese because they are Japanese. She thought that American kids would not identify with Japanese kids on the screen because the TV version is live action. So they felt that they had to Americanize it. So they recast and reshot all the pre-morph scenes with American actors. So they essentially Americanized it. It came out in 1993, was renamed Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and it was an immediate success, not only in the United States, but also became the number one kids show internationally. So it became incredibly globalized, but not through Japan, through the U.S. I spoke to someone in 1995, so 2 years after it had started, and we were talking about Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and he said, yeah, it's really become an American classic. And I thought, well, that's really interesting because it started in Japan. And I started doing field work on this project about then. And none of the kids that I spoke to then had any idea that Mighty Morphin Power Rangers came from the United States. So again, this was not that long ago. This was 1995. So this was a mere 13 years ago. I mean, a lot has changed in 13 years, which is, again, part of the story of the book. So just some more pictures of the Power Rangers. Here you see that they all come together. So they not only work as a team, all of their mechanisms, all of their tools actually come together, and you get one big weapon if all work together. So this was also the 1970s. This show was coming out of the 1970s. One of the things I do in the book is I talk about what else was going on in the political economy. This was the time of Toyotism and lean production, just-in-time production. I think you can also see kind of the ideology of work also in the fantasy of this kind of superhero. They all work together. They work as a team. One member is replaceable by another, but they're all important. Here's all their different weapons again. Also, the other word that's really important besides henshin, which is transformation, which is incredibly important, is the word gatai, which means come together. We all come together. So in this case, the weapons all come together to make a super weapon. Sorry, I guess I have a lot of images of these weapons coming together. So the second property that I look at in the book is, this is actually Kamen Ida. This isn't the Rangers, but you can see all the different powers, and these are the different powers of his transformation. The belt kind of literally comes out of his skin and empowers him. So does anyone know who this is? Sailor Moon. So Sailor Moon was the girl's version of the Power Rangers, also inspired by Bandai. She started out as a manga in 1992. Bandai saw her, thought it was time to have a girl's version, even though some of those Rangers in the Ranger show were girls. It wasn't really girly. They thought if they did a girly version of the Power Rangers, then they would get more girl equipment, girl toys, which were dolls. So up to that point, Lika-chan had been the number one selling Japanese doll for any of those of you who know Lika-chan. I don't have an image of her. And when Sailor Moon came out, Sailor Moon dolls actually sold more than Lika. So Bandai was actually successful. The idea is also girls who transform. But when they transform, surprise, surprise, they also get pretty. They also get sexy. So power up, and the word in Japanese was makeup. When they go through their henshin pose, they also get radically transformed visually. So this is her in her transformed state. The schoolgirl outfit becomes mini-skirted. She gets makeup. She gets jewelry. She gets a glow. She also gets cleavage. So you can see the two different styles. This is the lead one. This is Sailor Moon. She's Usagi-chan. She's little bunny rabbit before she transforms. She's also kind of an anti-hero. She's kind of klutzy. She loves to eat. She's really bad at school. She's a crybaby. She's a little bit annoying. But like Rangers, there are multiple. Started off with 5 and then became 10, the Sailor Scouts. They also work together. Nakama, a group, is really important here. But they're much more everyday. They're also much more into consumer goods. So in the book, I call this chapter Fierce Flesh, and I ask questions about also, is this a feminist hero or is it an anti-feminist hero? She's very sexy. She's a shoujo, young girl. And she was also the object of a certain interest by old men in Japan. So it wasn't just she was created for girls. It was a manga, and it was an anime. Lasted between 1992 and 1997 in Japan. Also crossed over to the United States. So in the wake of the incredible success of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, the gates were open and a lot of products started coming in. Some did better. Dragon Ball came in. A lot of others came in. This came in 1995. When it first came in on television, it didn't do very well. It came out by DIC Entertainment. It was considered a flop. They took it off television. But she, Sailor Moon, the product, had a lot of girl fans and also some boy fans. This was also kind of a gender-blended fan base. There were boys who liked it, some older boys who liked it. So there's a little queer stuff going on here, which I talk about in the book. I mean, interesting. There was something called SOS, Save Our Scouts. Fans tried to write in and tried to save our scouts, and they succeeded, came back on cable television. So it was kind of an interesting, at first it didn't succeed, everyone knew it was Japanese. People in Japan told me, you know, the reason this isn't going to work is American girls don't like anime, don't like animation. American girls will have a harder time with the schoolgirl. The schoolgirl is really Japanese. We can talk about that during Q&A. The schoolgirl doesn't really translate, can't get globalized. Actually, it did get globalized. It was incredibly successful in many places, like Spain and Canada. There are two different versions of the dolls here. Which one do you think are the Japanese ones, and which one do you think are the American ones? The American ones are where? On the bottom. The Japanese ones were considered fantasy. Fantasy is coded somewhat differently in the American market. The Japanese version have bubblegum colors for their hair. You can see they're pretty gaudy. It was said that when they crossed over, they had to have realistic hair color. Also, interestingly enough, their bust size increased. So I think they became Barbie-fied. So again, like Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, it crossed over, but there was an Americanization. Even here, there was a degree of Americanization going on. Does anyone know what this is? Tamagotchi. So the third product that I talk about are these virtual pets. Tamagotchi was an incredible success, again, put out by Bandai, 1997. Here you raise a pet. So instead of having a hero that is visually represented like the Power Rangers or Sailor Moon, now you have something that's not human. You have something that's not even realistic. You're creating a relationship that's not so much about identification. I mean, the fantasy relationship with the product now has switched. Now it's more that you're cultivating a relationship. The way that you play the game is that you take care of this thing. For any of you who have played, you will know exactly what I mean. You have to feed the thing. You have to play with it. You have to discipline it. At night, you turn off the lights. If it poops, you have to clean it up. So you have to tend to this thing, and the word for tending to it in Japanese is mendo. The person who created this game and tried to sell it to Bandai, originally Bandai said that they weren't interested because they couldn't imagine that this would be fun. They thought it was just labor intensive. And they said, there's nothing fun about this. But in fact, it first sold with OLs, office ladies, young Japanese women, rather than kids. And then it incredibly took off. I did a lot of interviewing about this, both in Japan and America. People would say, no matter what their age, they would say, it feels real. It really needs me. It's interactive. But of course, when people got tired of it, they would just let it die. There was also sadistic Tamagotchi sites to see who could kill their Tamagotchi quicker. And then when you felt the need to have another relationship, virtual as it is, and I call this chapter Prosthetics of Presence, you can also just reset. So it's an uncanny form of life. In fact, the guy who designed it said that he didn't really want you to be able to reset because he really wanted it to mimic life. And his fantasy, talking about fantasies, was that someday Tamagotchi would be sold in pet stores alongside dogs and cats. So this is a different kind of fantasy. It was incredibly successful in the United States. Everyone knew it was Japanese. No one felt that it had to be Americanized, in part because the fantasy really was globalizable in a way that Power Rangers and Sailor Moon were not. And then the fourth wave of property that I look at is Pokemon. And this was kind of the biggest of them all. And it started as a Game Boy game in 1996. The person who designed it, Tajiri Satoshi, was very interesting. He worked on this for 6 years. He was quite idealistic. He was a kid who was born in 1962 in a suburb of Tokyo. He was a bug player. He played with bugs. He collected bugs when he was a kid. He loved bug collecting. He felt that it allowed him to play with nature. He said nature was fascinating. It kept up ties with other kids. There was competition, but there was a sense of mastery. Then in his town, when he was in seventh grade, a video arcade came to town with Space Invaders. And he was bitten by a new bug. He started becoming a game junkie. He stopped going to school sometimes. He took money out of his mother's purse to play Space Invaders. He did manage to graduate from high school. And when he did, he started becoming a game designer. And he decided what he wanted to do was make a game that would meld these two different fantasies, these two different preoccupations. His preoccupation with virtual reality and virtual gaming, and his his attachment to bugs. So he tried to make a virtual bug collecting game, which is Pocket Monster, Pocketto Monster. And he also wanted to make this a game where it wasn't based on competitive matches. He wanted to also have it based on exchanges because he thought that that was very cooperative. And he ran out of money before he finished designing this game. Nintendo stepped in. Nintendo was willing to buy it. But Nintendo said, you know, about your desire to just have nice cooperative exchanges, you know, kids aren't going to buy it. So you have to have a lot of competitive matches. So in the very first version of the Game Boy game, it came out with 151 Pocket Monsters. You go into the game, you have to collect, you have to get all 151. The word in Japanese is getosuru, get. So there's also something very, talking about political economy, there's something pretty capitalistic about this game. The fantasy is very, very much about acquisition, about acquiring things. But in the original game, 11 of those Pocket Monsters could only be gotten through exchanges. So this for Tajiri was radical. He also wanted to make a game that would be easy enough to play. He said that the tendency in gaming at that point was to make it so complicated that the average age of gamer when he was doing this was about 28. And I think the average age is still about 28. But he wanted younger kids to be able to play. And he also said that living in Japan had become pretty isolating, pretty alienating, pretty hard for young people. Young people were being regimented to work incredibly hard, study hard. Kids usually spend a lot of time commuting. So he was also trying to design a game that would allow kids to have something beyond this incredible regimented life, that it would allow them to communicate with nature, albeit virtualized nature, that it would allow them to cooperate with other kids, that it would be almost socialist, utopic. That was in part his design and his hope. It was also created only for Japanese. He never thought that this would be global, had no interest in making it global. So when it came out in 1996, the prediction was that it would only last for about 3 months because the technology was considered not very sophisticated. It came out for Game Boy. Game Boy was on the wane. There was much more sophisticated game machines coming out at that point. But it was portable. And because it was portable, it really kind of fit in with today's Keitai kind of portable culture. And so it took off. And in taking off, then they expanded the empire. They came up with a manga version. They came up with a television anime. They came up with trading cards. And they tried to make it cute. So the original game was not particularly cute, but Pikachu was only one of 151 monsters in the original game. They decided that Pikachu would appeal to younger kids, would also appeal maybe to girls, would appeal to the cute side of boys, and would appeal to Japanese mothers, and so which they thought would make it a real good sell. And so it was expanded in all these different ways, and it became globalized in 1997. 1997, it started getting exported to other countries in East Asia. 1998, it came to the United States. It was launched in Topeka, Kansas in August 1998, and Topeka, Kansas was renamed Topikachu for the day, which is pretty amazing. There were flying Pikachus that they flew from helicopters that landed all over the city. And it became an incredible hit. There was Pokemania. When the first movie came out in 1999, Pokemon the first movie, American kids said that they were bitten by the Poke flu because it came out, I think, on a Wednesday. So a lot of kids played hooky so that they could go to Pokemon. So by this time, of course, everyone knew that this came from Japan. All the people who I talked to, they all knew that this was Japanese. So if you remember 1993, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers was kind of whitewashed, Americanized. The credits never showed that anything came from Japan. Within about 5 years, 6 years, it was totally fine to be out that it was Japanese. And in fact, I don't know how many of you watch Saturday morning television, but turn it on, take a look. A lot of the shows now either are coming from Japan or, interestingly enough, are staged to look as if they're Japanese or Asian or Oriental, which is another thing we could talk about, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. So I end this book asking, so now that J-Cool has become globalized, so what does that mean? Does that mean Japan has become, I mean, it's kind of changed radically. Its prestige in the global marketplace of kids' toys and kids' fantasies is really preeminent. It seems to have upstaged the prominent role that the U.S. has always played in global culture. Does that mean Japan is more powerful? Does that mean Japan has more prestige? And my argument is not necessarily. I think all of this stuff is a certain kind of brand, maybe a J brand, but that brand does not necessarily reflect back or emanate from a so-called real Japan. Nonetheless, a lot of students, I mean, some of you who may be educators will know, that a lot of students today who are studying Japanese are doing so not for the reason that they did in the 80s, to become businessmen or international lawyers, to become part of the economic miracle that was Japan now. No, it's so that they can watch anime or read manga and understand it in the original. And so this is fueling and feeding a particular interest of learning something beyond America, whether it or to what degree it's actually Japan, I think is something that's much more complicated, and I'm not quite sure that it's altogether salacious. So I'll end there. Thank you.